Everyone, welcome to the second episode of this podcast series. Raj Maitra, Chair of GI Research and Thought Leadership Board, and also member of the GI Board. And this is our initiative to expand the actuarial horizon and talk to, basically have fireside chat, a virtual fireside chat with people from different industries, professions, and different parts of academia. I'm joined today by my colleague, Laura Evans, to interview Jeff Saville and Nalan Kabi. Jeff is a part of Willis Towers Watson, and he's the head of weather and climate risks research. And Nalan is the head of flood research. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Hi.
So one of the sort of first questions that we tend to ask is, how has lockdown been for you, both personally and professionally?
Who should start? Should I start or?
Go for it, Jeff.
Okay, thanks, Nalan. Well, for me, it's been a very interesting time. I had my first daughter born just last November. So she's nearly 6 months old now in a few days. So it's been in many ways really good. We've managed to have most of pregnancy sort of without the extra time spent on commuting, and I've been around a lot more in the early months of my daughter's life. So that's been a real positive. And being able to spend a bit of time sort of exercising and doing the things that you've never got time for when you're heading into in and out of town every day. So London's a busy place, so it's allowed that extra space. So some positives there for me at least.
Yeah, same for me as well. So lots of positives, appreciating my lunch breaks a little more. And I like that now that the weather is getting better. Definitely some positives in there, but some challenges as well. Very real challenges when we had to go through homeschooling, especially. That was quite a big challenge for us. And I'm not a teacher, so I don't have the patience to go through it. But we survived. Thank goodness we survived. And I'm looking forward to better days.
And I think the general feedback I've received from my colleagues and friends is the children are as happy to go back to school as the parents.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So Nalan, can you share some sort of thoughts about the sort of work that you've been doing both in your current job and sort of in your past life?
Sure. So I'm a civil engineer by training. And then I worked as an engineer for many years in the US designing infrastructures, did flood studies for corporate clients as well as government clients in the past, mainly in the US. And I worked on K-12 school projects, designing stormwater management systems for those projects. Then I started working for a catastrophe flood model company, catastrophe modeling company, mainly focusing on flood models. And I developed several flood models at country level. I worked on US flood models, Japan, Europe, and several countries in Europe. Then I joined Willis Towers Watson to Willis Re specifically to start the model evaluation for flood projects within model research and evaluation team. So that gave me a chance to look at not just one model aspect, but evaluate available off-the-shelf available CAP models on flood from various vendors and evaluated those to identify the strengths and weaknesses of these models and how we should use them. Because as a known statement in the industry, all models are wrong, but some of them are useful. So knowing which ones are useful and how to use them is very key on risk management. And recently, I joined Willis Research Network to oversee the flood research projects. That gave me the opportunity to work closer with the academia and be the bridge between the business side of things and academic research and help both worlds to tackle some of the key and very hard to tackle questions that our industry is facing right now. That's me in a nutshell.
Thanks, Nalan. That's super impressive. We have quite a few questions for you on the flood modeling side, and I'm sure Laura will agree with me, but maybe we can move to Jeff just for his intro. And then, I mean, I don't know if Jeff was planning to share it with the audience, but I know a fun fact about Jeff, apart from amazing technical abilities, he's made documentaries, he's directed documentaries and hosted film festivals.
So wow, Jeff, you're letting my secret life out there. So yeah, that's something I do on the side, really. My brother and I, we run a small production company called Wild Indie. And, you know, we started with science and wildlife documentaries. He's an ecologist, a marine ecologist by training. So together we kind of bring the scientific aspect. But we both always liked sort of communicating and translating science in a way that's entertaining and interesting. And yeah, it's just really fun to do that through the medium of documentary. But we've also branched out to hosting film festivals as well recently. We've got our second Wild Indie Science Fiction and Fantasy Film Festival coming up. And it's in the Greenwich Odeon, if anyone's around. But yeah, it's an interesting sort of contrast to the world of finance. But there are definitely some similar aspects of sort of communicating, you know, sort of concepts and stories, which can help us understand some of the big themes that we face at the moment. But yeah, maybe that can come up again later if relevant. But other professional hats. So my background's really in weather forecasting, a meteorologist by training. I studied environmental science as undergrad. I've got a master's in climate change. And really my first job was to be a forecaster for the UK Met Office here for the British Isles and other international regions. And so that job really entailed taking the technical information from the weather models and sort of our interpretation of those weather models and communicating them and producing services and products for people who, you know, have sensitivities to the weather. And actually my first role was in the media side. So I would be taking all that information and turning it into, you know, just a short TV bulletin or a short radio broadcast. Quite often I do more radio. I've obviously got a face for radio, so I did more radio broadcasting than TV. But yeah, I did a little bit of the TV side as well. But mainly I'd be the one sort of briefing, pulling all the pieces together and briefing all the presenters so that they could provide a sort of a one story across the whole of the UK. But after that, I did a few different roles, but then I actually got a job in Bermuda. So I forecast for the Bermuda Weather Service for 3 years or so. I really wanted to forecast hurricanes. You know, my interest in the weather stems from loving extreme weather ever since a young child, really. So experiencing and forecasting hurricanes was a real win for that one. There's obviously some side benefits to living and working in Bermuda. It's a beautiful place to be for a short time at least. But I came back to become more of a specialist forecaster looking at flood forecasting. So I'm not sure if you're aware of the Flood Forecasting Centre that was set up between the Met Office and the Environment Agency back in around 2009 or 10. And that was really an effort to improve the lead time and accuracy of flood forecasts. So my role there was to provide the meteorological input into extreme rainfall events. And we worked side by side with a hydrologist from the Environment Agency to produce those forecasts in a timely and efficient manner. And yeah, real great success. It's really improved flood resilience in the UK. I think it celebrated its 10th anniversary just a few years ago. So that's gone from strength to strength. But I was there for a few years and then I became a business for the Met Office. Role really was about understanding the insurance and capital markets sector and what their needs were from the weather scientific community. So really a first foray into being this bridge between the academic community, the technical community and the needs of the finance sector. And that really led me to finding this opportunity with the Willis Research Network. So I joined Willis Towers Watson about 8 or 9 years ago now, working with the Willis Research Network the whole time. Initially more of a coordinator role, understanding, you know, trying to understand the business needs and turning those into research projects, which are both academically interesting, but also applicable and useful for our business teams and industry at large. You know, ultimately, the Willis Research Network projects are public science and they're going to be published in the literature and accessible to all. So, you know, the main benefit we have is this sort of co-production model where we can guide the research towards things that we specifically are asking. But, you know, as long as they're academically interesting and publishable, then, you know, it's open science. But really being that bridge between the academic world and our business. And in recent years, I've got more involved in some of our strategic work around climate change and understanding how we can develop new services and sort of reviewing some of the services that are available to the market, and also involved in consultancy projects, sometimes along the lines of the stuff that Adiraj gets involved with, but also with large corporate clients, advising them around sort of climate risk disclosures, or just generally understanding their ESG credentials and how climate will be affecting them in the coming years.
Thanks, Jeff. I know that someone told me this story, that Dr. Greg Holland, who is very known in the sort of, climate change and windstorm and...
Tropical cyclone expert, for sure.
Yeah, so someone told me this story that when he used to work in Bermuda, he used to fly a plane into the eye of a storm just to sort of measure it better. Hopefully you didn't do anything of that sort when you were in Bermuda.
No, well, I mean, I did do some training at the National Hurricane Center, which is based in Miami. And they also were training at the same time some of the hurricane hunters. So what you say there, the flying the plane into the eye of the storm, is actually the job of the hurricane hunter. And they have reconnaissance aircraft, which, I mean, they don't fly through the eye wall. They fly above the hurricane. So what they really do, they fly over to that hurricane and they have a plan to do transects. They do a crisscross and they go around the perimeter. And all the while, they're dropping instrumentation into the storm. So it's measuring the wind speeds and humidities and temperatures and things. And that gets transmitted back to the airplane and they take all that data back. And then they have a much better understanding of the structure of those storms. So that's invaluable data in real-time forecasting and also, the academic aspects of understanding the physics behind development of tropical cyclones.
Indeed, that's fantastic information. But going back to sort of what you mentioned, Jeff, in your current role as part of Willis Research Network, you've been the bridge between academia and kind of the financial sector or the real world. How has it been, and what would you say are the sort of benefits and even the challenges?
Well, I mean, it's not always easy. There was actually a report put together by the UK government called the Dowling Report in 2015, which reviewed academic and business collaborations and some of those challenges, some of those opportunities. And one of the biggest things that generally comes up is around IP. There are some really sensitive issues if you're trying to produce scientific work which is open to peer review and to open publication. How do you manage that IP so that, it's shareable, but also it's something that we can benefit from ahead of our competition, really? That's the main goal. And as I mentioned just before, around that sort of co-production of science, by being close to the projects the whole while, from the very inception of the idea and turning those into academic questions, we can help guide those projects to be close to the various services and various sort of questions that we're working on for our clients. And so, really, we can be the first. It's a kind of a first mover advantage. We can provide that insight ahead of our competition, and then hopefully guide the industry as that science becomes public domain. And really, in many ways, that's kind of a knowledge brokering role, both internally and externally. We're not just brokering the transactions; we're also trying to sort of translate and turn academic expertise into things which can be usable by the industry. So that's definitely the main benefit. But IP can be a challenge because most of the partners that we work with have a remit to, provide that open science. And good science is accessible, it's repeatable, it's robust. So if a project isn't repeatable, i.e. if the data isn't available in some way or the methodologies are kind of too sort of shrouded in sort of generalities, then it's essentially it's not producing science that's fit for academia. So it becomes product development for the private sector. Most of the IP in private sector development is IP that's protected because there's investment that goes into it, and therefore the advantage is for the person or for the company that created that investment. But the Willis Research Network works just a little bit different. We try and take the questions that we can't answer ourselves, or we don't have the means or the inclination really to investigate and work on. And those academic questions can benefit from that longer term attention that the academic community can provide and that peer reviewed attention. And that's actually one of the other challenges, I think, is the timescales involved. Quite often, as you mentioned just before we started this call, we've got very busy schedules, there's lots going on, some deadlines sort of looming, and they come out of nowhere sometimes. So really trying to make sure that we can deliverables and usable outputs on a short-term basis through the course of a project, as well as having a goal maybe a year or 2 years or even 3 years down the line, which can be something which is a bigger academic finding that we can publish and present. I guess the other real benefit is to make sure that the industry knows that we're doing this stuff. It's really cool work. It's really interesting stuff. So, we want to make sure that we take that opportunity to not necessarily promote the work, but definitely publicize it. We try to raise awareness of the research network and projects that we support. So just a few thoughts there. There's a lot more to it, of course, but I could go on all day about that.
I think that's really interesting. I think it ties back quite well to the comment that Nalan made that I really enjoyed, that was that, you know, all models are wrong, but some are really useful. And I wonder, Nalan, if you could just talk about that just at a high level. We all are very aware in this group that flood risk is extremely challenging to model. And I wondered if you could just talk more broadly about the sort of strengths and weaknesses in the different models and where you think we're getting it right with modeling flood risk and where you think we're getting it wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. Yes, you're right. Flood is one of the hardest perils to model. That's why I think when you look at the overview of CAT modeling industry, it started with hurricanes and earthquakes, and then flood is included in the modeling suite of models available. So flood is really high resolution hazard. So you need to have really detailed high resolution terrain information, exposure information, and being able to model quite high res and detailed so that you can get feasible, reasonable outputs out of it. So because the hazard is so location specific, you need not just location specific information when you're building the model, but also you need location specific information when you're using the model. So one of the big challenges, the vendors have come a long way. When you look at the early generation, first generation flood models, they're much more simplified and they use relatively low res data to put together. And along the way, you have to make lots of assumptions, simulate natural processes, right? It's a very chaotic, really very complex natural phenomena. So you can only simulate it or model it as you make lots of assumptions and simplify the processes. So early generation models were simplistic in that way. But now, over the years, I would say the off-the-shelf CAT models are trying their best to capture all sorts of sources of flooding, including riverine flooding and urban flooding, and also the interactions with other perils, etc. So the available suite of models, from the technical point of view, they come a long way and they're much better right now. And that doesn't mean that they're at their peak. There's always room to improve from the modeling perspective. But then one of the key challenges is when you look at how people are using these models, especially the portfolio exposure information, you see aggregated information put into the model where you expect to see meaningful results, where since the hazard itself is location specific, so you have to provide very detailed level of information to run the model. So we don't see it all the time. And a lot of information is missing. And when you look at these models, they have all these options available that you can adjust your outputs, specify first floor elevation or, you know, the foundation types and whatnot, specify, choose different vulnerability curves, etc. That information is not necessarily available in every client that are using it. So that's a challenge that I see from the hazard perspective and from the user side of things.
Thanks, Nalan. So, I mean, purely from initially, maybe ask you the question purely from an actuarial perspective, in the sense that as reserving or capital actuaries, when we sort of think about this type of risk, and there are some challenges with modeling, there are some challenges with data. How would you suggest that we as professionals, insurance professionals, approach this problem?
Mm-hmm.
Best to estimate the additional uncertainty or even the sort of primary or secondary uncertainty?
Yes, exactly. So I think one of the key things that we should, as users or users of these models, be aware of is the uncertainties associated with these models. There are inherent uncertainties that comes with the flood hazard itself. And then so when you see the model outputs, whatever the software spits out as a number, don't take it as is and be aware of the range of possibilities and the distribution around that number. So 100 year exceedance probability might look like a number, but it's not that simple one number you should go with. There's a distribution around that number. So be aware of this and take the outputs with grain of salt. And that's important. And then the other thing is knowing how the models are put together, what are the assumptions, will help you understand and use the outputs wisely. Because sometimes the models assume, I mean, there are so many assumptions that, as I said, that you have to make when you're putting these models together. And then one of the other important aspects, a lot of people look at multiple model outputs, which is good to see the range of distribution, range of possibilities, range of outputs. And even though majority of the models use start off with the same data sets, same principles, because of the assumptions, because of the how the models are put together, the answers can be completely different. You might end up a really wide range of results using two or three model outputs. So knowing what is covered, where the loss is coming from is key, and understanding all the assumptions and knowing the uncertainty distributions around the outputs is key. So that requires for any user, I think for any company who's using CAP models, they need to invest in-house or, you know, work with a broker that has a proper model evaluation catastrophe analytics team in place so that we can evaluate all different aspects of the models and provide custom solutions for a specific portfolio, for instance. Because keep in mind, these models, when the vendors are putting these models together, they assume the ideal portfolio that is uniformly distributed everywhere, assume you have, you know, the ideal situation, which is not necessarily fit for purpose for every client out there. So that's why I think educated users are needed. It's not button pushing. Ultimately, it's not that. So you need to ask right questions to the vendors. You need to understand the client needs to provide a fit for purpose solution for them.
I think that's really interesting, Nalan. And yeah, obviously with the flood aspects, all the different ways of using and interpreting floods, I think that's a really key point to have that expertise to, you know, not just run the models and to process portfolios through the models, but to really be able to interpret them and understand them and to, you know, avoid any misapprehensions around, you know, the outputs and how they might be used. And, you know, obviously for flood models, I might just add to that, you know, the flood models are often driven by rainfall input. So now you're also adding another layer of uncertainty from the weather models that go into that, the weather and climate models that go into that. And with current conversations around climate risk, I think there's even more uncertainty which needs to be addressed and accepted and incorporated into any kind of analysis. You know, the catastrophe modeling world often uses the sort of historical record as a basis to create a sort of a simulation of current climate. But there are questions around that as well. You know, if we're looking at a non-stationary climate, i.e., we've been warming over the last few decades, especially in the last 3 or 4 decades. You know, how has that affected rainfall patterns? How has that affected that sort of longer term view? So do we use that full historical record or do we use something more near term? You know, that's one of the questions that the catastrophe modeling industry is, you know, tackling at the moment, not just for flood, but for storms and other perils as well, that other hazards. And then obviously, you know, if we're thinking about this climate change challenge that is currently sort of facing the industry, you know, how do we project forward? You know, the biggest uncertainty really into the future is what the human race does or what the human society does to curb carbon emissions and therefore reduce the effects of global warming and its knock-on impacts on society. So yeah, you know, understanding all those scenarios really is a real challenge. You know, coming from a financial sort of stress testing mindset, it's quite useful just to look at, you know, a temperature rise, a temperature delta from now to whatever time in the future. And I think that's an important point to mention. If you look at a +1 degree or +1.5 or 2 degree stress test, that can be multiple time horizons dependent on which scenario we end up following. You know, we just don't know at the moment. So really understanding what those projections mean and what they are is important. And, you know, many of the consultancy projects that we've worked on, you know, they either want to look at that sort of temperature-led thinking where, you look at a temperature to relate essentially to a change in risk, and that can happen at different times into the future, or they have a particular time horizon in mind, in which case, you know, the temperature becomes the main variable, and therefore, you know, at the sort of 2050, 2040, 2060 in the future, then we can have a different understanding of what the risk might be according to, you know, the various scenarios. So yeah, there are different ways to slice and dice the data, especially going forward. You know, it's very important to remember that these are scientific models and they're used as guidance for international policy, of course, But, you know, when we're using them on the scale of the insurance sector, for example, and especially as input to a CAT model, we're going from something which is designed for broad scale features and broad scale understanding of the climate system to, you know, the impact on a particular asset or a particular portfolio of assets. So, you know, it's designed, the two types of models, catastrophe models and climate models, are designed for different reasons. So we definitely need to be cognizant of that. And, you know, climate models can be downscaled to, you know, high resolution or high level of detail, but we need to understand the uncertainties that are generated when that process happens. So if you go from a very coarse global climate model, which is about a 1 degree resolution, maybe 100 kilometers grid boxes represent over the whole globe to represent how the weather patterns change. If you go from that down to, you know, a single asset or a 1 by 1 kilometer grid box, you know, there's a lot of assumptions that go into that, and there are different ways to do that. So being aware of how far we should downscale, just because we can downscale down to sort of really high resolution doesn't mean we should. And it raises the question of sort of precision over accuracy. You know, you have to understand the uncertainties that go into those kind of processes when we start to interpret climate model outputs. So yeah, I just wanted to sort of elaborate and sort of expand on that conversation on flood, to, you know, some of the broader input models really, which are starting to be used around catastrophe modelling.
I think that ties really nicely actually to sort of the question I wanted to ask next, which was around the sort of experience you had with the Flood Forecasting Centre. And you talked a bit about the how you use the meteorological input from extreme rainfall events to improve UK flood resilience. And resilience, it's one of the things that they talk about a lot within Flood Re and that we've been talking about as a flood working party. It's one of the potential solutions to help deal with climate change and the impacts of that in the future. But I imagine there's going to be a number of other solutions that are going to be developed across the coming years. And I wanted to put to you, what are your thoughts on how we can use modelling to develop or understand the impact of those solutions? And where do you think modelling is leading the way in that space? And where do you think modelling still has some way to go?
Well, I guess it's modelling as well can be thought of in different ways. You know, we talked about the two different paradigms of modelling, the catastrophe modelling versus sort of climate modelling and weather modelling. I think, you know, weather modelling and climate modelling has, you know, advanced hugely over the last few decades. Accuracy of weather forecasts is much better than it ever was, and the resolution of climate models and the various kind of assumptions that they have had to take in the past have also sort of improved. And so really sort of trying to use the outputs of sort of this general circulation model. You might have heard the term GCM, which stands for general circulation model, often confused with global climate model, but then that's another conversation. But yeah, really, you know, trying to use the outputs of these kind of physical models of the environment is the way to go. You know, I think we have to sort of step forward from a catastrophe modeling perspective. We have to step forward from purely looking at historical records. Because one, you know, the historical records are relatively, generally catastrophe models look at extreme events. And so therefore we, by the very nature of extreme events, we just don't have many examples. When we start to use physical computer models, which actually model the, you know, the weather patterns and the interactions between the oceans and the temperature and the sort of the oceans and the atmosphere and the land surface changes that have occurred over the years and potentially could occur in the future. When you start to model all those different aspects of the Earth system, we can start to, you know, model the things which we haven't seen in the past. And there are actually some really interesting projects in academia that we've been linked to, and we know some academics working on one looking at it's called the Unseen Project. I think it's led by the Met Office, but yeah, I might have to check on that to make sure. But another of the Met Office in the UK are definitely involved. And it's really to look at those types of events, which we don't have examples of in the past, and to look at those extremes within the weather modelling sort of community. How do we better represent the extremes of weather and climate through the use of these coarse grid climate models? So yeah, I think those kind of projects which are, you know, we're trying to make steps towards the kind of understanding, the kind of questions that we need to ask from a financial perspective, and especially in extremes, are really important. But it's not just about extremes as well. We have to think about the slower onset changes too. So things like sea level rise and temperature change, you know, they will change the way the world is, or the way industry runs, like heat stress, for example, with gradually increasing temperatures and sea level rise. You know, there'll be, you know, changes to sort of coastal resilience, and, you know, sea level rise has a direct relationship to storm surges, for example. So the storms may or may not be increasing in frequency and severity, but if you add on to that the impact of higher water, then the current level of sea defences may not be adequate into the future. So these kind of things start sort of approaching that resilience question. And I think again, from a resilience perspective, thinking about the financial sector's offering, I think a lot of it is around adaptation, of course. So, you know, there's two ways of responding to climate change. You can adapt to the changes that, well, we have to adapt to the changes that have already occurred, but going on into the future, dependent on which scenario we follow, which carbon pathway we follow, we will have different levels of adaptation versus mitigation. So, and that's really part of the design around the various scenarios that are used by the IPCC and the academic community, and have been translated into scenarios for the financial sector as well. Is, you know, those two kind of, I guess, axes, whether we're thinking more about adaptation or mitigation, being reducing carbon intensity and trying to get to sort of carbon zero or carbon negative society, versus adaptation, which is, you know, a lot around where the insurance sector sits, in that, you know, we provide that sort of ability to bounce back and to recover from extreme events that, you know, may be changing into the future. So that, yeah, those kind of two aspects. I think resilience fits more with the adaptation framing of our response to climate change, whereas mitigation is more kind of longer term strategic and probably policy led in reducing carbon emissions. I think, I kind of rambled around a few concepts there. Hopefully I sort of touched on your question there.
If I may add, I think Jeff raised really good points about resilience and how we should look at the adaptation and mitigation can use available tools. If we look at, for instance, CAT models, they're designed to simulate tail events, the extremes, and so that we can have an idea what would be the range of worst situations that we can see in a catalog of events, for instance, and that are still useful. And then when you look at the core components of these CAT models, especially in flood models, you can see flood defenses play a significant role. So that gives us an opportunity to utilize CAT models to stress test different investment decisions around flood defenses, for instance. We can use those models for our benefit. And the other thing is, because of the nature of probabilistic outputs that they give us, obviously, they're not as detailed as an engineering models. For instance, there are super high-level engineering models available that are used when you're building structures, infrastructure. So those are the ones that are used when you're designing those infrastructures. They're more on the deterministic side. But because there is a pattern change, especially when you look at precipitation patterns, there are some changes that we're projecting. And those changes can be captured really well, and that should be also addressed in our decision-making processes as well. Those changes are captured well in climate models. So ideally, to respond to any type of resilience action, we have to look at all different tools and then know what those tools are used for and know what we can learn from these tools, climate models, CAT models, engineering models, so that we can come up with a strategy to design a future that is much more resilient to flooding. And we're creating some adaptation strategies, and for the long term, we're coming up with mitigation measures against changing levels of risk.
Thanks. Was quite interesting. But I mean, what my question is, so if we sort of take a step back, and you made quite a few good points around data management, it's important how we're slicing and dicing data, the understanding the model type and purpose, because different models are used for different purposes. You can't kind of use one for every purpose that you can think of. And then finally, it's about understanding the output and the use of the model. How can you sort of use the number that's coming out, whether it is a 1 in 100, whether you're looking at occurrence exceedance probability or average annual exceedance probability, and kind of thinking in terms of what kind of variability might be around that number. So maybe if I were to think of the big picture, do you think there is enough education? Do you think there is enough knowledge, especially from a sort of actuarial perspective? Do you think the industry can do better to link up the academic research that's been carried out to better understand how we can use this technology, modeling data that we have access to?
Maybe I'll go first, Nalan. But yeah, I think absolutely there's always sort of room to improve things. There's always room to progress our understanding of the data that's available and improve our use of that data. I think sort of going from, you know, how the general level of understanding, I think it's quite apparent, especially again with the sort of climate change aspects that people are discussing at the moment. There's a drive from the regulatory perspective, which I think, you know, does provide an opportunity for companies to spend some time in kind of brainstorming and trying to understand, you know, what we can and can't answer. So I think, you know, we're in the process of acquiring that knowledge and sort of skilling up really in what we can do with the climate model data that's out there. But I think, you know, there's at the moment seems to be a proliferation of climate analytics services which are being developed, and you know they range in sort of quality and depth, and you know some are very sort of top down, some are very kind of detailed and bottom up. You know, at Willis Towers Watson, we're developing our own as well, trying to sort of provide a more holistic view from both perspectives. But you know, there are lots of different offerings at the moment, and I think, you know, we need a kind of maybe some guidance from whether it's the regulators or whether, you know, one of the large financial institutions to provide some guidance on, you know, how to use the data and what kind of assumptions that need to be taken. Because at the moment, you know, there's a lot of different ways to use the methods and outputs coming from academia. And, you know, even, you know, if we just look at extratropical cyclones, or European winter storms, for example, you know, if you look at one paper, you might see that, you know, the intensity of storms is going to be increasing, or the track of the main storm track is shifting to the north. So, you know, if that's taken on face value, then, you know, you might make some assumptions around your portfolio, which have a very limited view. But, you know, the way the scientific community works, it's constantly evolving. The latest consensus is generally the best consensus to go with. And, you know, there'll be papers released probably which will be contradicting that view. I know for that example, there are papers which say the opposite, that the main storm track is shifting further south. So, you know, you can find aspects of the predicted changes which, you know, you can kind of hang our hat on and sort of be more confident with, and other aspects which, you know, if you're not sort of taking a full literature review or a full broader perspective upon, you know, you could end up having a sort of a misguided approach to a problem around one of these big hazards which lead the industry. So yeah, I think we just have to be careful. I think I agree with you that you know need for greater education in the insurance sector. Obviously, you know, the insurance sector has experts in all different fields, and actuarial experts, catastrophe modeling experts, but bringing that sort of climate science aspect to it, I think, is really important. And you know, not just from a data perspective as well, I think, you know, some of the services and some of the solutions that I've seen, you know, take a very data-centric approach. And climate models produce huge amounts of data, terabytes of data, which are quite hard to use in many ways. So yeah, we definitely need data scientists to be involved in manipulating and representing that data. But also, as we said before about, you know, how to use catastrophe models, if we kind of use climate model data, we also need experts in climate science to pair with the data scientists and with the experts that we have internally. So really, I think, you know, there's definitely greater understanding needed by the industry. But we've also seen an increase in interest from the academic community wanting to, you know, approach these big challenges and these big questions that the insurance sector have. You know, they're really interesting scientific questions. So I think there's also scope for the academic world to learn more about the insurance world and the finance sector, about how risks are modeled, how economic models work, and sort of the marrying of these different disciplines, I think, will be a very exciting space in the years to come. I mean, we see some models which attempt to do this, integrated assessment modeling, for example, which is more of a top-down way of creating these sort of global scenarios around policies and the economic impacts. But I think there's room to progress that, and especially when you start to incorporate the expertise from the catastrophe modeling community into these kind of broader, holistic views of risk.
Mm-hmm. If I may add to what Jeff said, well, educating the industry or helping both worlds understand what is needed in each world is quite tricky, but people like us are doing exactly that. Willis Research Network facilitates this nurturing environment for both worlds to communicate to each other and understand each other and try to help each other as well. So academics, well, one of the main thing that you do science or, you know, spend time in research is hoping that is used in some way, it's not for the sake of research. Most people, most academics want their findings to be used and applied in real world. So, but they need to hear firsthand from the industry what they're trying to tackle, what are the key challenges they're facing on a day-to-day basis. And from industry side, they were most of the time, academic papers, published research, it can be intimidating because it has lots of equations, lots of prerequisite knowledge that requires you to understand these papers. So it can be a bit intimidating. So us, like as Jeff said, knowledge brokers, facilitating that conversation, translating that academic language to day-to-day applications to business language, allows both worlds to learn what's going on each side. And they now, because of the regulatory push, especially around climate change discussions, this is quite accelerated. That both way educational piece, understanding both worlds type of discussions are super accelerated because there is an regulatory push, because there are some expectations in the market. So you don't want to be left out if someone is filing their financial disclosures around climate related risks, then you'll be like, I have to do something similar too. I need to learn what my risks and how are they changing in the near future and the long term. So that pushes people to listen more and search, reach out to academics to answer some of these questions that they have to answer. Industry is looking for practical solutions. Academia is has been studying climate science for decades now, right? What's going on in that area? They've been looking at it for decades. As Jeff said, the outputs of these models are extremely complex, and you cannot necessarily pick a number and apply it to your decision-making process. So it is, I think, now, because of this regulatory push, everybody is in this brainstorming phase and trying to find that practical solutions using that intense model outputs, and so that you can actually use that insight from academia and apply it to your day-to-day business. So it's the perfect time, perfect place to be, I think. And it's quite exciting for both worlds, because climate science is evolving. From academic side, it's a challenging question still, even though they've been looking at it for or trying to understand it for some time. From industry side, there is some, because of the regulatory push, it's now, and the societal push as well. It's not just regulatory push, but the societal push makes it quite relevant and timely for them to invest in and try to understand it deeply.
Yeah, I think a natural sort of next step of this discussion might be around metrics. When we start to bring together these different modeling paradigms, these different modeling spheres, you know, what are the appropriate metrics to use when we start to think about flood from a climate change perspective? Obviously, in the future, it's very difficult to validate anything as well. You have to take into account that. We have to sort of trust the narratives are well represented by the data that we choose. But yeah, those metrics I think are really interesting. I mean, is annual average loss and occurrence exceedance, you know, are they going to be relevant for the kind of questions that we're going to be asking, you know, over longer time periods? And I think, you know, around sort of how insurance contracts are built as well, the wording, the policy details, some of those might be better sort of being slightly modified to represent a longer term view of risk, maybe multi-year deals. I know they exist. I don't know how prevalent they are, but maybe that's a way that we can start to incorporate some of the climate variability in the short term. But, you know, over the period of a mortgage, you know, maybe there's a way to average that out and look at sort of that longer sort of chunk of risk in a more aggregated way. Maybe that's a way to reduce some of the uncertainty as well, to sort of smooth out some of those potential differences in the scenarios. And ultimately, I think we've got to remember that the scenarios do take a while to diverge, whether it's the worst case scenario where the we sort of carry on with carbon intensive industry and we carry on sort of encouraging carbon dioxide concentrations to increase and global warming to carry on, or whether we do manage to mitigate our carbon intensity or our carbon footprint and sort of reduce the potential for global warming. I think we just need to sort of make sure that we you know, look at these next few years in a fairly sort of detailed way and make sure that we know that you know, we're kind of locked into a certain amount of climate change. So we need to deal with that first. I think there's always going to be an adaptation element to that, and also properly represent the current climate that we're in. I talked about the non-stationarity of historical data. But then as we start to diverge a few more decades into the future, you know, then I think we're going to have to really start to explore those different narratives, those different scenarios in a way that makes sense to the industry or to the companies that we work for.
No, that definitely makes sense, and it's fascinating sort of conversation, and I think we can probably continue discussing it for another hour if we want. And I'm conscious that today is Nalan's day off.
Yeah, very generous of your time, Nalan.
Oh, my pleasure. It's always fascinating to discuss these topics. So.
Indeed, and I think we need to sort of create a more awareness, not only around sort of, as we say, data, around modeling, around its use. And I think to our listeners, if you want to reach out to Nalan or Jeff with any questions, please feel free to do so. So when we sort of publish the podcast, there will be a LinkedIn link and you can sort of get in touch with them, and I'm sure Laura would like to get in touch with both Jeff and Nalan, flood working party perspective, and we will probably also try to share the link to Jeff's sci-fi film festival at Greenwich Odeon. I'm definitely
very, very generous. I wasn't expecting a plug.
Laura, any last words from you?
I just wanted to say it's been really great to be able to pick your brains. It's been really interesting and a really fascinating discussion, and I hope the listeners find it to be the same. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks everyone.